Live from Chicago, this is Chris Roebling, substituting for Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, we've got commentary by Walter Jacobson, a legendary newsman here in Chicago, Joe Morris, former assistant United States Attorney General, and Bob Kramer, noted activist and author. Our program is coming to you from our home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in beautiful downtown Chicago, where the snow is falling and the temperature is in single digits. Our toll-free phones are now open at 1-800-723-8289. That is 1-800-723-8289. And our website, of course, www.beyondthebeltway.com. Well, thanks, thanks all. Walter Jacobson, your first visit to the program, I understand?
It is.
Well, it's great to have you on. Joe Morris, longtime friend of the program, as is Bob Kramer. News this afternoon, as we were coming over to the station, almost literally coming over to the studio, a video, according to the New York Times, a video released this afternoon by the Islamic State appears to show the mass beheading of a group of 21 Coptic Christians who are made to kneel beside the sea in what is identified as the coast of the Mediterranean near Tripoli, Libya. Now, this news coming out this afternoon as Copenhagen police are saying that they believe they did, in fact, kill the principal suspect in yesterday's apparent lone wolf terrorist attack in Copenhagen. And obviously, these news events are bringing into focus once again our policy towards global terrorism, ISIL, ISIS, and these events around the world. We've seen Ottawa, we've seen New York City, we've seen Sydney, we have seen Paris, most notably recently, and now Copenhagen. Walter Jacobson, let's start with you. Is the United States doing enough to stop this scourge?
I would say the United States is not. I don't think the ISIS troops have been intimidated to any degree whatsoever by our actions with bombings over the Iraq and Syria, and they are certainly not afraid of anybody else putting them down. They seem to be more aggressive than they were even 2 days ago. This killing in Libya of the Egyptian Coptics is just, I mean, it's wild. It's beyond belief.
Bob Kramer.
Well, I think it is important to note that the action that the president's taken against ISIS stopped a blitzkrieg advance in Iraq and Syria. And I do agree with our generals that I think they are on the defense now in the broad sense. They're prone to these kind of spectacular events precisely to do what they're intended to do, terrorize people and make them look bigger than life.
Joe Morris, is the United States doing enough?
No, and we're not playing the game right. We're doing some things that can be done in terms of military opposition, but we're not playing the political or the diplomatic game at all intelligently. Start with the proposition that the victims of ISIS are not a bunch of random folks at a deli. The Coptic Christians who you're telling us were murdered in Libya were murdered precisely because they were Christians and non-ethnic Arabs, that is non-Arabs. The Copts are descendants of the original population, the pre-Arab population of Egypt. These are not randomly chosen victims. They're chosen for specific reasons. And if you want to fight an ideological enemy, you have to be willing to engage the ideological enemy on the level of ideology, of thought, of theory, of politics, of undermining the moral claims that the enemy makes. We don't do it.
Well, how do we do it? How should we be doing it when we're facing very different kinds of threats? Now, so let me just enumerate. We have obviously organized war-making capability that is somewhere out there between Jordan and Baghdad and Amman in Syria. I mean, Syria. You've got the bulk of their so-called army. You've got these cells that are around the world that seem to get activated or could be added to by some of the 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 foreigners from the West who are in the army right now and could return home.
So the question is not only how can we do something about it, the question is can we do anything about it? I mean, if we increase our military actions in the Middle East, it's just going to aggravate the ISIS troops more, and they want, don't they, to draw us in so that they'll have a ways to get the Muslim world to get behind them even more than it is.
Joe, you say the president's not doing enough, the United States is not doing enough. What kind of thing do you prescribe?
There need to be boots on the ground, as the phrase goes. The boots don't necessarily have to be American boots at all. They could be Turkish boots, Iraqi boots, Egyptian boots, all kinds of boots. We should be helping supply those boots. We should be helping encourage the arrival of those boots. It's one thing to supply from a great distance air power. We're doing that. Jordanians are doing that. United Arab Emirates are doing that. But it's another thing to meet the threat on the ground, face-to-face, village-to-village, hamlet-to-hamlet, as often has to be done. The other thing we're not doing is we're not fighting the battle morally. We're treating these people as if they're some affront to 21st-century social sensibilities as opposed to a gut-fighting battle for hearts and minds of people. And we haven't been doing a very limp job of that in the Obama administration, we've been doing a very limp job of that for the last 20 years.
Bob Kramer.
Let's just be clear that the foundation of ISIS was formed when the Bush administration and the Cheney administration recklessly invaded Iraq and kicked
that's
over the sectarian.
Let
me finish. And kicked over the sectarian hornet's nest that caused the collapse of that regime and the collapse of the society. Millions of people have either died or left. A vacuum was created all this time, creating the dynamic that allowed ISIS to flourish. And let's be clear, if we do it again, we will make more terrorists than we stop.
Let's join this issue. Are you saying that Joe's proposal of this multinational boots on the ground with a lot of folks, a lot of troops coming from the region, okay, are you saying that that would be the equivalent of sending in the 102nd Airborne?
I'm saying the United States should not have another ground war in the Middle East, A.
Okay, but what does that mean relative to what Joe proposed?
I think the president's actions with respect to his use of air power are entirely appropriate.
Okay.
I think the training mission to create exactly what he's saying among forces in Iraq and Syria are entirely appropriate.
He's not saying that. I'm saying
I would.
Mr. Obama is not saying that.
He's certainly saying training people in Iraq and Syria to take on the opposition is exactly part of his policy.
What is this question about boots on the ground? The boots are on the ground. We've got 400 or 300 to 400 troops outside the al-Assad air base in Iraq. We've got people who are in airplanes bombing. That's a war. That's not...
That's right. But it's not engaged in ground combat operations that are, as they say in the AMUF proposal, enduring.
But that's language. That's not reality.
I think that's an important distinction.
Well, I think that's a distinction we've got to explore when we come back on the other side of some comments. And so I want to get to the level of not only our commitment and how we're encouraging others to participate, but also I want to look at how this relates to the bigger strategic issues that are confronting the world and world peace. It's Beyond the Beltway. I'm Chris Roebling in for Bruce Dumont. Great panel, Walter Jacobson, Bob Kramer, Joe Morris, and you. Stay tuned. We'll give that phone number on the other side of these words.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
It is Sunday night, and the place to be is right where you are, next to your radio. I hope the hot cocoa is on. We got snow, we got cold in Chicago, and our friends in Boston have got it in spades. So nestle up to that radio and listen to some great conversation about things going on in the world. Very disturbing things going on in the world. We open the program with reading some copy from the New York Times website about this very disturbing video, apparently, of 20 Coptic Christians from Syria who have been executed by ISIS. And we're now in the throes of a conversation about how much the United States can do, how much it should do, and how much it should get others to do. Walter Jacobson, our friends, Bob, you and I are in for a treat because Bob and Joe, they can really go
ahead. Let's listen to them.
But I want to get back to you for a quick second. Is there a leadership vacuum in the West? And here's another reference point. In Minsk this week, we saw a meeting about the Ukraine.
Right.
Russia was there. The Ukraine was there. France was there. And Germany. No U.S.
I think Barack Obama considers himself, if he's being realistic about it, as kind of a distraction. There is so much talk about him being a weak leader of the West that if he went there and he had these two strong people, Merkel and Putin, fighting together, Barack just wouldn't be able to stand up to him because it seems to me anyway that he doesn't quite know what he wants to do. Of course, as the Republicans have been saying, and you've been saying so much, Joe, that he doesn't have a strategy. So I don't think Barack Obama missed much. I don't think the world missed much by Barack Obama not being involved.
And is that flowing over into the question of global terrorism?
Well, it is, but what we have to consider is that the nations in the Middle East are not united behind us to help. They're pressed to help, and they do when they're pressed too far. But they've got too many things at home to worry about, and too much of this transformative business about the Islam that is not going to make a difference.
You know, the one thing we've seen that has changed the game, I think, in terms of the other, particularly Sunni powers being interested in being involved, is the level of over-the-top violence at this. I mean, the burning of that Jordanian pilot,
yes,
in the cage really sent not only Jordan, but I think a number of the other Sunni states into a tizzy and recommitted them to this battle. This will drive the Egyptians to be seriously involved, I think. I mean, you know, part of this, we'll see. I mean, you know, if this doesn't begin to precipitate, I think, more engagement of a number of our allies.
Well, Egypt's also already saying that it's going to do what Jordan did. Egypt is saying this evening that it's not going to stop and it's going to take revenge for what happened to these Christian Coptics.
Exactly.
Joe Morris, is there wisdom in Obama's stepping somewhat aside to allow folks in the region to take on more of the immediate responsibility of destroying ISIS and ISIL?
In immediate sense, of course there is. The answer is yes, and that's in no small measure because Mr. Obama doesn't have a strategy about what to do or a vision where it would go or why to do it. And I think it's important, I'll echo something Bob Cramer was saying a moment ago here in a slightly different way. What powers in the Middle East are going to do with respect to ISIS, such as the Jordanians or the Egyptians, they will not do as favors to the United States because they're little agents of the great Satan trying to carry our water in the region. They will do what they're going to do because they have huge stakes of their own, as do the Saudis and the other Gulf Arab states, including the United Arab Emirates. There are a lot of vectors. There are a lot of players in the pot in the Middle East. There's the whole Sunni-Shia problem. There's the Arab-Persian problem. There are true small L liberals, people who want to be free, who object to the corruption and the tyrannies of all kinds of local regimes all throughout the region. They all have their own interests, and they're all legitimate interests. What the United States in the past has done is it's applied two things. One is assistance to good guys, to the extent that you can identify good guys, and the other is an overarching philosophical perspective on how the conflicts, how these conflicts fit into larger moral questions.
Well, under the neocons that came before President Obama, we also had something else that they did, and that was to be the biggest bull in the China closet. I mean, a strategy? I mean, the neocon gang, I mean, to hear them talk about foreign policy is astounding.
Okay, okay,
they launched the biggest failure in the recent history of American foreign policy.
This is the Obama-Kramer strategy. Foreign policy is to blame Bush.
It doesn't go any more depth than that.
Bob, I
know you and I have been debating this for many years. Your feelings are spread upon the record. Okay, so let's. But if not a pax americana, right? If not some kind of overall balance in the region, then what are the terms on which these local issues to which Joe refers, which I think we all acknowledge, how are they going to be worked out without the kind of violence that we're seeing in Sana'a, Yemen,
right,
where a friend of the president, a guy the president was saying, this is the guy we got to, that guy barely got out with his skin, okay? And so Libya and Egypt, we ended up with the Muslim Brotherhood attacking the people who are now supporting us. Okay, so my question is, what's your vision? How does it proceed from here? Even if you think Bush was a
The near-term problem requires the engagement, as Joe said, of the self-interest of the various players in the region, and allows them to be front and center in the resolution of these issues. That's what we didn't do in the previous administration that I think was so dangerous. The long-term solution to these issues have to do with development, have to do with education, have to do with investment in economic possibilities. I mean, you know, you can't expect large numbers of people to have no prospects and not be lured by crazy radical ideologies.
So the development in the region is going to be helped by the locals taking over? Walter, do you think?
No, the development I think that Bob's talking about is from help by the United States. And I don't see that that's going to make a difference. It's certainly not in the long term.
In the near term, that's not a solution. In the long term, I think it is.
If by development, Bob Kramer's talking about an American welfare program for the Middle East, that's nuts. What's necessary is civilizational opportunity, civilizational change, the opportunity for liberal forces on the ground, native liberal forces, Arabs who embrace the idea of a secular state, a non-religious state, to have some breathing room. I don't disagree with that at all.
Are we looking for a Turkic solution? Are we looking for Kemal Atatürk of the rest of the region? In other words, the guy who established a modern secular Turkey, which was both Islamic and secular and respectful of many different traditions and belief patterns.
That did a lot of good in Turkey and that part of the world for many, many decades. It may or may not be something replicable in other societies and other cultures around the region. There are a lot of things that are going to indeed have to be homegrown. There is not a cookie-cutter matrix that fits all these problems.
Our phone number is 1-800-723-8289. That's 800-723-8289. We've got a caller listening to us on WLS in Chicago. That's Brian. Brian, your bottom line point for the panel, please.
Good evening. I think we should avoid foreign entanglements, as George Washington said. And a factor you're not addressing is, I believe, overpopulation is an issue. That region has five times more people than it did in 1950. And I think we should try and quarantine the area as best we can, and we must get control of our immigration.
All right. Well, we lost Brian there. He was saying, I don't know about quarantining the area. Let me ask the question on Brian's behalf. Walter, is it possible to step back? Is it possible in the 21st century for the United States to adopt President Washington's admonition?
I certainly would think not. I mean, the realities of today's world are such that we can't do that. There's no way to avoid getting involved in this. But I think we've got to work on the long term, as Bob says. But the question right now is, how do you stop these massive, crazy massacres? Although, when you compare them to what else is going on in the world, 250 young women captured by the Boko Haram.
2,000
people wiped out.
The
media doesn't give that the kind of attention it gives to one guy being killed.
Well, you start adding up the numbers. Yazidis, Copts, women in sub-Saharan Africa.
Christian children in Syria.
The numbers start getting very large. And when you realize that there is an ethnic cleansing going on throughout the Arab-Muslim Middle East of Christians, the safest place in which to be a Christian in the Middle East today is in Israel, and that ought to strike people as no surprise. But what ought to strike people as shocking is that the levels of Christian populations in the Arab world, from Morocco in the west to Iraq in the east, is shrinking at a fierce rate. It's really quite frightening, and it's not accidental.
Is that a concern, Bob? Not that you're a spokesman for the Obama administration, but how do your friends on the left view that kind of obvious element in this picture?
I think the president has been very clear that in case of ISIS, military power is all that's going to stop them. The question is, how do you deploy it in a manner that does not enhance their attraction? And, you know, a narrative of success for them attracts people around the world to them. We don't want that. And there's no question the military power is necessary. That's why we're using air power. I think the question of that has to be merged with a sense of behaving respectfully to the people who are right there and not acting like we are the great imperial power that's going to – that won't work. We've seen it fail for the last 20 years when it's attempted. So we have to have the more engagement that this administration is trying.
We're talking about engagement. We're talking about the steps that the administration will take. There are two big issues that are actually percolating this early in the year over in Congress. One of them is the president's request for use of force authority, and the other is funding for the Department of Homeland Security. And neither of those appears headed safely right through the congressional straits, okay? And I think what we want to talk about when we get back with your phone calls at 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289, what should Congress add to this picture? We've seen what the president's been saying. What should Congress add to this picture? It's Beyond the Beltway Sunday night. Chris Roebling in for Bruce Dumont, and we hope you're sticking with us right after these words.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
You're invited to the biggest party in Texas, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. March 3rd through the 22nd, legends and up-and-comers in concert. Plus, superstar cowboys and cowgirls, blue ribbon livestock and horse shows, western-themed shopping, cool food, acres of carnival rides and games. The Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo.
Party with your boots on.
March 3rd through the 22nd, RodeoHouston.com.
Party with your boots on.
Beyond the Beltway, Sunday night's national political conversation, and we're glad you're joining us. My name is Chris Roebling. I'm sitting in for Bruce Dumont, who takes a deserved night off, but he'll be back next week. Our phone number is 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. And before we go to a couple of calls, I want the panel to do a little self-introduction, okay? Self-introduction. Bruce likes doing this at the bottom of the first hour, so here we are. Let's do a little self-introduction. We'll start. Who's ready? Who's ready? Walter Jacobson.
Self-introduction. My name is Walter Jacobson. I've been covering news in this town for now 60 years.
Whoa.
I'm almost afraid to say. And I am focused primarily on inside politics and government in this local area. But like all people who are good citizens right now, I'm listening to what's going on around the world. And I'm thinking that the first thing we better do is figure out what people in the Middle East are thinking. I don't mean the leaders of the countries. I don't mean the leaders of the military. But the average person, we don't know what his or her attitude towards the transformation of Islam is into this ISIS business. And we'll never get anywhere unless we understand what they're thinking.
Bob Kramer.
I agree with that last point. Bob Kramer, I'm a Democratic political consultant, and I've been doing politics for 45 years, and my firm is Democracy Partners, and I'm the general consultant to Americans United for Change.
There you go. Joe Morris.
I'm Joe Morris. I'm a lawyer in Chicago. I'm a Republican activist, have been for about 40 years. In a galaxy far, far away, long, long ago, I was the chief of staff and general counsel of the United States Information Agency, and Walter, I had a bureau under me that did exactly what you wanted every single day. We had people on the ground throughout the world, including throughout the Middle East, sampling public opinion on a daily basis, using our own surveyors, hiring local people to do surveys, the local equivalents of Gallup organizations, trying to funnel into policymakers in Washington some sense of what people on the ground in those countries, some of them not free countries where public opinion was a pretty dicey business, what they actually had to think and say about things. It wasn't an easy business. The United States Information Agency, the public diplomacy arm of the U.S. government, which was everything from Voice of America Radio to WorldNet Television to the Fulbright Scholarship programs to U.S. libraries.
Libraries abroad, yeah.
Abroad, all kinds
of American
things.
Library
the whole, of Paris. The whole quote-unquote propaganda operation of the
so
U.S.
So that information that you gathered is no longer available or nobody's paying much attention
exactly,
to it.
Exactly, exactly. And one of the great failings of the United States government in the last 25 years is in the so-called peace dividend with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of the Cold War. The United States Information Agency was abolished and not replaced.
Yeah. All right. Well, we got so many war stories around this tale. To hear from Walter about Ernie Banks, or to hear from Bob about the early days of the Obama campaign, or to hear from Joe Morris about the day that President Reagan fired the air traffic controllers. And
my war story about the abolition of USIA, Chris, is a war story of a self-inflicted wound.
I understand.
That is to say, it's something that has not been cured in the last 20 years, and we're paying the price for it today. We cannot engage in public diplomacy with the peoples of the world because we don't have the instrumentalities for it.
What happened to the information that was gathered over all those years?
Where'd that all go? And who were the consumers of that information, Joe?
It's gathering dust in the consumers.
No. At the time,
at the time, everybody in the National Security Council, right. The president, the secretary of state, the national security advisor,
and it also
CIA,
went to
everybody.
It went to CIA, DIA, NSA.
Absolutely everybody.
It also went to the top congressional folks.
Sure as hell hasn't done much good.
Well, I think this isn't a partisan statement. I think it was doing a lot of good in those days.
At the time.
Yeah. I mean, it was getting around. Nowadays, I don't know what. All right. But we got to get to callers.
We don't know exactly what the current. My wife would. She used to be on the Intelligence Committee until last year, but correctly, she never told me those things.
Right, well, we're not learning much if President Obama thinks that that these people are picking random folks in delis as their.
Yeah. That was, Bob, do you admit that that was a major gaffe on the part of El Presidente?
What's that? When
he said they were randomly...
They were shooting random folks in a deli.
Random folks in a deli.
I'm not sure that's what he meant. I think the point he meant...
Wait a minute. Hold it. Walter, were
no,
you
I
present?
Don't buy, I don't buy that.
Were you present when they said don't report what the mayor said? I think you were at that press.
I was.
Okay. What did they say?
That was Harry Bush, wasn't it?
All right. Wait. Walter was there.
Hey, you guys in the media, why don't you report what the mayor is thinking instead of what he's saying?
There you go.
We'd say, no, well, it's not very likely that Richard J. Daley told us what he was thinking. No more certainly than Richard M. Daley.
The man you're quoting was the late, great Harry Bush, right, who was, believe it or not, Richard J. Daley had a press secretary.
That's right.
All right. We're going to go to Lynette, and hopefully she's going to sort some of this out for us. Lynette is listening to us. I think she may, or Jeanette may be listening on Sirius XM POTUS. Jeanette, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Please, your bottom line point for the panel, please.
Well, I wanted to discuss the ISIS issue.
Go ahead.
I'm an international relations student, and we, in terrorism class, we learned about how military engagement actually exacerbates the problem by creating hatred towards whoever is the person bombing these countries. So the normal Middle Eastern person doesn't necessarily have access to the information that we do. So they just see it in a perspective as we are getting bombed or my neighbor is getting bombed, and what are we going to do about this? So I feel military engagement is not the solution. We have to form some sort of education or some sort of different approach to combat this issue because, I mean...
I understand what you're saying, and here's my quick question for you, and then we're going to let you go. Does that help protect people tomorrow in the region who may be victims of violence?
No, but I feel like it's a small step. If we take the first step right now, instead of using military engagement, we try to come up with a different solution.
She's absolutely right.
Thank you very much, Jeanette. We appreciate you calling in.
And that's what a public diplomacy operation does. It engages people in the level of ideas. It joins the argument. It tries to reach them on some moral plane. And we don't do it, and we don't do it well.
Don't interpret everything as political here. I said at BEZ when we were on there many thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
We know that the United States and the West traded security and stability and a steady supply of oil from the Middle East, right, for reform. Everybody, that wasn't a secret. That wasn't a Democratic idea from Lyndon Johnson. It wasn't a Republican idea from Gerald Ford. Everybody was in on that idea, and including any number of governments of the United Kingdom and de Gaulle when he was still alive, et cetera. I mean, that was a knowing choice. Are we now not, and all of us knew at the time that a day would come when we would have to pay the piper. Are we now simply paying the piper for that choice then, or are there elements now that are added to the mix?
I don't think there's any question that to some extent our support for what you might call anti-democratic elements in exchange for stability has had negative consequences for us. The other thing that the caller said, I think, is absolutely right. At a certain point, our use of military power, in particularly unilateral military power, creates more terrorists than it stops. On the other hand, and this is where it becomes a complicated question, limited use of military power may be necessary. If we got an outfit like ISIS is starting to run all over the Middle East, you're going to have to stop.
Since we're talking about the president's request of Congress for use of force resolution that is new and that has perhaps ambiguities about, say, on-the-ground operations or specificities in some other areas, like in 3 years this is going to expire, it's going to have to be. Can we all agree that there are more Al-Qaeda like terrorist organizations visible today and numbering their soldiers and their activities than there were even just 5 years ago?
Oh, certainly. But we don't know how much of that force is among lone wolves or small cells that we don't have any information on. And I don't think that's because our intelligence operations can't come up with it. It's just that these things are so quiet and so secret. And because of the internet right now with social media and all that, we don't know who's saying what to.
It's certainly true that they go through permutations, and they've been growing them and metastasizing a lot in the last 5 years. But they're not new, and they're not just new in the last 10 years or the last 20 years or the last 30 years. Remember, Al-Qaeda declared war on us, 25, 30 years ago, and we didn't know it. It was like they were the Grand Duchy of Fenwick. What's the novel?
The Mouse That Roared.
The Mouse That Roared. Right. They declared war on the United States without us being aware of it for 10 years. Lots of things happened that were elements of that war before we realized on September 11, 2001, that we were engaged in it.
And recall that Al-Qaeda was a spinoff of the Mujahideen that we had funded to try and prevent the Soviets from continuing to dominate Afghanistan.
Yes, I mean, and no. And I mean, there were elements that definitely some, but maybe not all. But yeah, I mean,
that's right.
There are some complexities. There are always
those complexities. That's exactly right.
Right.
And
I want to go back to, for instance, the caller. Does anybody know how much the Bush administration and then the Obama administration, both administrations, have spent on aid to Baghdad? Okay, to Iraq for schools. Do you have any idea? It is in the hundreds of millions, over $1 billion, probably maybe even on schools alone, into billions of dollars. Okay, so I think when I hear a nice young student like that, and I guess she was from Miami, so she might be at the University of Miami down in Coral Gables, which has a big international relations program. Couldn't be nicer. Happy to hear from young students. But I wonder how much her professors are talking about the fact that we have had established bureaucracies in Baghdad for the last 10, 12 years pushing American dollars into Iraq for schools for girls.
And Chris, the sad thing about that is, to use the thinking of the young woman who just called us herself, there are some people in the Middle East who are more furious with the United States for educating women in Iraq than they are for dropping bombs anywhere in the region.
I think that's true.
That was Walter Jacobson. Just before that, Joe Morris. And a little before that, Bob Kramer. They're the all-star panel for our program this evening. My name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for the illustrious Bruce Dumont, who will be back next week. It is Beyond the Beltway, Sunday night, and we're going to be back with you after these words.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a 4-diamond hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City. At HiltonUniversal.com, they let you be the star in Hollywood.
Sunday night, Beyond the Beltway. My name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. He'll be back next week. We're talking politics and national politics. We've spent most of this hour on the challenges facing the United States, the Western world, by the terrorist threat, and coming off the terribly disturbing report this afternoon about a new video from ISIS, ISIL, showing the mass beheading of 20 or more Coptic Syrians, Coptic Christians. Two big issues in Congress right now. Walter, I want to get everybody's opinion here very quickly. We've got the use of force resolution, and we've got the funding for Department of Homeland Security.
And of course, they are connected, right?
And they are connected. What is the way that President Obama will get what the country needs out of Congress?
Oh, there's a difference between what the country may need and what the president may need for his legacy, and there's not going to be, it doesn't seem to me, an agreement in Congress. Maybe we can get more specifics from Bob here, but it seems to me that all they're doing is playing politics. One side wants more restrictive notions in the bill. The other side wants fewer restrictive notions. The Republicans want anything that will embarrass Barack Obama, and to spend all that time to work out plans and then deliver them to Obama, which they know he will not accept. I mean, it's ridiculous, right?
Bob Kramer?
Well, on the Homeland Security front first, I mean, I think they're in a blind alley. They're in a box canyon, the Republicans.
Who is?
The Republicans,
okay.
Are. I mean, they should pass a clean Homeland Security appropriation bill to fund at all times. Here, we just spent the last hour talking about ISIS and these security threats. They're gonna not pay the people who do Border Patrol and TSA and so forth.
Why are they proposing not to pay those people?
Order to repeal, that is to roll back the president's executive actions on immigration that are widely popular and are absolutely within his power. And president's simply going to say no. He will veto anything that cuts into that, period. That's all there is to it. He's made that very clear.
Joe Morris?
On the Department of Homeland Security appropriations bill, what I would do is pass it in segments. If you can agree on something, pass it, send it up. If you disagree on something, pass it and let the president veto it. Frame the issues very clearly so people can debate them. If the president has overreached with his immigration executive orders, that's fine. Repeal those or pass remedial legislation. Let him veto them. Frame the issues for debate. Don't throw all the issues into a single pot. My view on the use of force authorization measure that the president has requested may be a little bit different from other Republicans. I would pass it exactly the way the president wants it.
Yeah.
The president has asked for authority. I would give him the authority that he has requested for. Don't cram further authority down his throat if he says he doesn't want it. Let him take this fight the way he wants to take the fight, and not allow him to follow the Obama
strategy
of blaming Republicans.
But Bob, there are Democrats,
yes,
in Congress who oppose elements of the president's
proposal. The biggest concern is that in the current format, it allows the continuation of the original authorization of force that was passed
2001,
which is now ad infinitum, and which would empower future presidents. I don't think there's any Democrat that doesn't trust Barack Obama not to engage us in another land war in the Middle East. But I think there are a lot of people who worry that whoever the next president is may use that authority to do things without congressional authorization.
Well, the saddest thing about all this, and what may undermine any plans to get something forward going on Homeland Security, is that the politicians in the Congress are motivated strictly by what they're going to do when they go back to their home districts, and they don't want to be attached to the war.
I'm going to use two words next to each other, which you really have not heard for about 6 or 7 years. Conference committee. okay? To have a conference committee, you have to have a bill that is passed by the one body, say the House, and then passed by the other body, which is in this case the Senate. And then when there are differences between those two measures, they go to an institution referred to as a conference committee. When I was a staffer, I had to sit in on appropriations committee conference committees, and let me tell you, it is a mind-numbing experience.
There have been no conference committees in the last many years.
Why is that?
Because Harry Reid wouldn't allow them.
Oh.
All right.
Bob, we're going to get to you in a moment about that.
Now, unfortunately.
What do you get with a conference committee?
You can get an agreement between the Senate and the House.
Okay.
But unfortunately, a conference committee cannot force an agreement between the Congress as an institution and the President as an institution. You have no alternative but, under the presentment clause of the Constitution, to send a fully passed bill to the President, and he has two choices, to sign it or to veto it.
Now, Bob, so, what happened with Harry Reid and the conference committee institution?
Well, I don't think that it's fair to say that he wouldn't accept conferees. I mean, on some things, there have been bottom-line differences. Now, we don't have Harry Reid as the leader anymore.
Okay, 10 minutes.
The problem
right now is between McConnell,
who can't pass this Homeland Security thing.
Okay, and time out. Yeah. When you say a bottom-line difference, you see, to me, having worked there, I think a bottom-line difference is the conference committee is meeting, and they cannot come to agreement. And you and I have both seen in our lifetime Johnson, Ford, Carter intervene with conference committee
members.
And
let's be clear that there was an agreement between all the parties as to an omnibus appropriation bill last fall that was exactly what you just said, with the exception that the House then said, nah, not unless we do in – Homeland Security, the president's immigration provision, which, of course, had nothing to do with appropriations anyway.
Well, it had everything to do with appropriations.
It carved out
the Homeland Security appropriations for further debate, and that's what we're having now. Whether the debate we're having now is a wise debate or not is certainly something we can debate. I think we're getting lost in the weeds here. The important thing, I think, is for decisions to be made on the various issues that contribute to the Homeland Security, but they should be passed and sent to the President. With respect to the use of fourth authorization, the President's proposal has a 3-year sunset provision.
All right, that's it. That's Joe Morris. I'm Chris Roebling. This is Beyond the Beltway. We're going to be back in a few minutes talking presidential politics and more events around the country. Please stay with us.
Yeah. I mean, wait out.
Chicago, it's Chris Roebling with our second hour of Beyond the Beltway with Bruce Dumont. Bruce, taking a very well-deserved night off, he'll be back here in this chair next week. It is our analysis of national politics featuring real insights from an incredible panel tonight. Legendary Chicago newsman Walter Jacobson, longtime Democrat activist and agent provocateur Bob Cramer, and of course also longtime Chicago Republican activist and attorney in private practice, Joe Morris. A lot of political stuff this week that we want to get to in this evening's conversation. I want to bring up this issue about a big week in the media with the passing of Bob Simon of CBS News. Obviously, kind of the detritus, the following, you know, flotsam and jetsam of the Brian Williams story. And I think a moment of some national attention given to the president making this video for BuzzFeed to talk to young people, who we were just talking about signing up for Obamacare before the 15th of February. Okay, so let's take those. To me, Bob Simon was a very, very special member of the national media.
Of course.
And Walter, you spent 35 years with CBS, and you were regarded, you were, I think the Columbia Journalism Review said you were one of the finest local TV anchors in the nation. Your view of Bob Simon?
Well, my view is like, I suppose, you know, yours and everybody else's. He was a hero in our business. It's just tragic the way he died after spending all those years fighting the elements and wherever the wars were being held, and then he comes back and gets killed in a car accident. And, you know, his time was running out at CBS anyway, because there are so few of us of our age and who care to listen to the news of importance and quality. It's been taken over by the Brian Williams of the world, who are more actors than news reporters, for sure. The Brian Williams story is by no means over. I think it's going to continue with more information coming about the mistakes, not only the fabrications, but the embellishments of his role in covering the news. There was a new one today about him saying, I didn't even know he said this, not only on the news, but on David Letterman, that he was given a piece of a helicopter as a souvenir. Well, you know, the military goes crazy when it hears these kinds of stories, and there are going to be more of them. I think Brian Williams is finished. I mean, I respected the guy. He did good work. He was a good investigative reporter. But he, like so many of them now, many of us, I suppose I ought to say, are actors as well as we are. No, I'm not going to say that. I'm not an actor. Yeah. But the people who are major players in the media now and television news are more actors than they are journalists.
Do they get seduced by celebrity?
Well, of course they do. And they go further down the road of celebrity as they are some more successful. And the management wants them to do that because that's what draws an audience. That and the kind of garbage that leads all the newscasts these days, particularly locally.
I got to get back to that question, but let me quickly hear from Joe and Bob on this. Bob, your thoughts on the passing of Bob Simon and the departure of Brian Williams?
Well, I just don't understand the Brian Williams story.
How
I don't know why you do that. Yeah. Why would you do what he did? So there may be more to it than that. The Simon thing is, I do think you're right, Walter. There's a whole generation of very astute journalists who we have much fewer of. Let me just add one other wrinkle, though. There is an extent to which lots of people consume their news now from the internet, from fast breaking stuff off Twitter, off the internet itself. I mean, you mentioned earlier that the president's video. That was aimed at reaching people where they reach consume media. I thought it was very cool, by the way. But it's lots more people, and particularly in younger generations, consume their media that way. And that has economic consequences for the capability of some of these big broadcast news organizations. I think that matters.
It worries me that people get their information with attitude, or that their desire for information is to get information that comes with a certain flavor. I think we are losing something as a society, as a civilization, where we're not getting our information in a more literate way. I don't mean to fawn over a colleague here at this very panel, but one of the great virtues of Walter Jacobson's personal commentaries for years and years on WBBM television, local CBS in Chicago, was the literacy that came with those comments. They read well. They weren't just something that you listened to. You could actually read the transcript, and they made sense. The subjects had predicates, and there were literary allusions, and there was a careful choice of language. It wasn't simply all in the tone of voice or the facial expression that accompanied it. The Brian Williams story suggests to me some personal pathology. It's so self-defeating to be telling lies about oneself that are so easily
determined
and overturned. I'm put in mind of nothing so much as that fabulous character in the old Mary Tyler Moore show, the pompous, hot, airbag Ted Baxter in the newsroom in that fictional television station up in Milwaukee. There are just too many Ted Baxters these days.
Well, that's too many Ted Baxters, and I think, Bob, you hit on something that makes me want to go back to Walter. Do the economics of national or network TV news, do the economics support the kind of, I would say, nurturing of major anchor possible talent.
No, they clearly they do not. Part of the reason being what you just mentioned. You know that the people are interested in things that don't mean as much seriously as things that do. And there's just not enough money to spend because of the internet as there used to be. They can't invest in people like Bob Simon to go around the world and do what he did. And locally, not only in Chicago, but everywhere around the country, locally the money is spent on pictures and movie stars and drive-by shootings as opposed to budgets and international affairs.
There's a lot of promotion of network primetime programming, isn't there? I mean,
the news.
That's what I mean.
Yes, of course.
There's a lot. You see that segment in what you would call this third segment of the newscast, and they're talking to somebody about what it's like to be in a network TV program on that network.
Right. There is so much concern now about the more stringent news budgets that the competition becomes even more difficult. And as that happens, the product becomes even less competent and good. Certainly things not in context anymore. That's really too bad.
That's Chicago newsman Walter Jacobson, joined tonight by Joe Morris and Bob Kramer. My name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont on Beyond the Beltway. We're going to be back to talk about developments in the presidential races. They're nascent, but they're out there. They're going, just like you are, but don't change that channel.
Everyone loves vacationing in Florida. So why not experience it as it was meant to be? Where turquoise Gulf waters meet tranquil island beaches. Feel the powder-soft sand between your toes. Revel in a glorious island sunset. Shop the boutiques of a seaside village. Ride horseback along tranquil waters. This is Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Real, authentic Florida, where you can discover an intimate downtown and sip cappuccino at a sidewalk cafe. Catch fresh fish for dinner. Even tour a working winery. Just minutes from all the rest Florida has to offer. Bradenton, Anna Maria Island, Longboat Key. Plan your visit online at BradentonGulfIslands.com. That's BradentonGulfIslands.com.
It is Beyond the Beltway. My name is Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. Extraordinary panel with us this evening. Joe Morris, former Assistant United States Attorney General for International and Security Affairs. And Bob Kramer teaches legions of young liberal activists through the Midwest Institute. Is that right? The Midwest Center?
Oh, there's Midwest Academy.
Midwest Academy.
We've done a lot of campaign field programs, were we?
Campaign field programs, and then Walter Jacobson. If anybody is out there, you look up Walter Jacobson on the internet. It is unbelievable how many journalistic awards you have racked up. Peabody, many, many television Emmy awards, and of course in Chicago, the very coveted Peter Lissagor Award. Many of those as well.
Right.
All right. Great to have you on.
Thank you.
This week we had in the presidential sweepstakes a couple of little kerfuffles. I mean, nothing really amounts to much at this point. And obviously we've got more going on with Republicans than we do with Democrats, because Hillary seems so far ahead of there isn't even really a pack. There's sort of Hillary, and then I guess Joe Biden did find his way to Iowa this week to find out if he has any saleability out there. But I don't think anyone really sees themselves defeating Hillary. Who knows what will actually happen. But on the Republican side, we had a couple of things going on. Scott Walker made a long-planned trip over to the UK to burnish his international credentials, to get a little bit of exposure to the rest of the world. And he was asked by a British news presenter about evolution. He declined to answer the question. He said, what I want to see is evolution in the trade relationship between Wisconsin and the United Kingdom. And this turned into a mini tempest in a teapot, as did the Washington Post's attempt to find out why did Scott Walker leave Marquette University at the beginning of his eighth semester. Then we saw that Rand Paul was brought up for saying that he had a degree from, I think, Baylor University as undergrad, when in fact, like Scott Walker, he just never finished at Baylor, but he got directly into Duke University Medical School, which is no slouch medical school.
Right.
Okay. Do any of these things amount to anything, or have we done our service by mentioning them?
I think the thing on evolution is indicative of a huge problem in the Republican Party.
Really?
I mean, here is a guy who will not say if he believes in evolution. I mean, this is this anti-science wing of the Republican Party that wags the dog and is wagging the dog now, by the way, on a lot of other things, this tail on immigration. You know, this is a huge problem in the upcoming primary and the general election.
Joe Morris.
The careful listener will have just heard Bob Cramer fulminate over the fact that somebody doesn't believe in evolution. And that's exactly how the question was put to Governor Walker in the UK. The presenter asked him, do you believe in evolution? Which is sort of a nonsensical way in which to present the issue if one takes science seriously. It's not a question of belief. It's not a question of faith. It's a question of where does the evidence and where does the scientific method take one. But Democrats are so insistent on making this a question of faith and belief, as in the notion of their belief in global warming, that it turns out to be an ideological or a religious question as opposed to a factual or a scientific question. It is a meaningless kerfuffle. It was a silly question to be asking Governor Walker, and I thought turning the question into one, I believe in the evolution of the relationship between our two countries was a wise thing to do. The kerfuffle about his history at Marquette University was a search for dirt.
Yes.
Was there a sexual scandal? Was there a cheating scandal on grades? Was there a financial scandal? It turns out, no, there was none of the above. His student record turns out to be pretty good. He was pretty well liked. He was known to attend class, although he was somewhat indifferent in some classes. He had a lot of friends. He was seen on campus, unlike some people who've been elected president of the United States. And it turns out he had a pretty good reason for leaving campus. He was offered a job he couldn't turn down. It was quite lucrative.
Here comes Jacobson, the reporter. Okay?
Yeah. Okay, Jacob, let's hear it.
Why do you say that the whole issue of global warming is belief? Don't you believe, or haven't you seen the mounds and mounds of research that say it exists and it's dangerous?
The research does not call into question my beliefs. It's not a question of faith. It's not a question of belief. It's a question of where the evidence leads.
Yeah, but the evidence leads to...
Not a belief. It should not lead to faith.
Well, it has nothing to do with belief.
I agree with that, and that's why it was a silly question to ask.
The question is
the
belief in the accuracy of the theory that is based on evidence. And a lot
that's
of people
not a question of religious faith. It's a question, not a question of belief.
Don't believe in science. They don't believe – they think that
So let me just ask you a question. Ask you a question when you say they don't believe in science. University of Wisconsin-Madison, University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, Whitewater, La Crosse – Stevens Point, some place like that. All of them have chemistry departments. All of them have physics departments. All the physics and engineering equipment at the University of Wisconsin-Madison is probably second to none, maybe Texas A&M, maybe the University of Illinois. Does that indicate that Scott Walker is squishy science?
Where
practically speaking – when he's on a trade mission, where does that fall out?
He doesn't want to offend a base in the Republican Party that is absolutely does not believe that the science of evolution is true.
No, you are saying that Walker is squishy on science. I mean, if Walker
Walker is squishy on science on the basis of nothing other than the fact that Walker declined to answer a stupid question.
And so I'm asking you, if Walker has been, I think reinforcing the University of Wisconsin's engineering school, which is one revered, Frank Lloyd Wright and all the way since.
I don't know where Walker stands. I'm talking about the dynamics in the Republican Party where there is an attempt being made by this candidate not to offend a group of people who are absolutely anti-science.
All right. Now
I see all of this as a distraction from the issues that really matter.
Of course.
Brian Williams.
No. Well, that too. But the issue with Walker is his position on organized labor.
Isn't it?
Oh, my God. Certainly much more than where he may stand.
All organized labor?
Well, public employees.
Yes.
Okay. His position on all organized labor.
Oh.
On the question of whether or not unions should flourish and raise the wages of ordinary Americans, which is the central issue of our economic time.
That is the danger of this issue for Bob Cramer and his Democratic allies, which is that Scott Walker and other Republican governors have their fingers on the pulse of something really, really important, which is that there is a growing enmity between public sector labor unions, which ride on the public trough, ride on the back of taxpayers, and private sector trade unions, labor unions, which ride on the welfare of the American people by making honest living.
Now, let me say, I have to say, because I want to be asked by Bruce to do this again, that I am actually clicked onto a Walker for President Illinois friend page, okay, on Facebook. I want that to be clear, okay? And I like Scott. I also like the governor of Indiana,
Mike
Mr.
Pence.
I had lunch with him a couple of weeks ago. I like Ted Cruz. I like Rick Perry. These are all, to me, they're all great guys. So I want that to be absolutely
clear.
Well,
isn't there a difference between liking them as personal beings or liking them because
That's
of
right.
their stand on issues?
But I think Walker actually is, I wanted to get to this issue of why the media cares so much about Scott Walker's undergraduate years and indeed Rand Paul's and never really asked any questions about President Obama's. But let's leave that aside, because I think this whole issue that Bob raises and that you raised, Walter, is what distinguishes Walker and indeed a lot of other folks like John Kasich is the post-war public employee sector union model fiscally sustainable.
You know,
if you go to Puerto Rico, you find out Puerto Rico no longer exists as an independent fiscal actor. Puerto Rico is now controlled by five hedge funds that have bought all of its paper because it could not break out of the post-war public sector union spending model.
We are wealthier today as a society than any society in human history per capita. To tell you you cannot afford to pay people living wages who work for us, who work for the public. I mean, Governor Rauner in Illinois here this last week went crazy that the average wage of ordinary workers for the state is $64,000. That's a middle-class income. This comes from a guy who makes that much money in 2.5 hours personally, who made $52 million.
So what?
Outrage.
He's not the person paying the bills. Ordinary taxpayers.
And he should be paying the bills is exactly the point. With the increasing amount of our income concentrated
at the top of the
1% of the
population,
that's the fundamental problem. To solve the problem in Illinois, have a progressive income tax, simple as that.
But Joe, your presumption is that, and you said it, in fact, now it's not a presumption, you believe that the state employees are on welfare, that they're not doing their work.
Yeah.
That's your belief.
How do you know that?
We don't know that.
Joe, did you say that?
I didn't say that they're on welfare and they're not doing their work, although I do say that I think they cost more than the value they create, they contribute
you
to the society.
You think a guy who lays concrete and asphalt on a road ought to make less than $49,000 a year?
Most of the people who lay concrete and asphalt on roads are not state employees.
Very few state employees do that. It's all privatized.
It's not entirely privatized because Governor Rauner was against it.
In order to pay the bills of public sector employees, you have to do what Bob Cramer wants, and that's to increase taxes on middle class Americans.
No, on wealthy Americans. Excuse
Bob,
me.
You can't pay these bills.
One at a time, and we got another half hour.
Middle class people.
Your targets are middle class people. Middle class people are not the targets at all. They are your targets.
Let me give you an example of what we ought to do at the federal level.
One at a time.
At the federal level, my wife, Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky, has a bill to increase the number of tax brackets above $400,000, which is the current place where the tax brackets end today, at levels far less than they were during the Eisenhower administration, so that billionaires have to pay a higher tax rate than normal middle-class people. That's what we need to be doing.
And that's Bob Cramer. And he is talking taxes, and he's going to keep that up after a few short minutes of announcements with our other panel members, Walter Jacobson, Chicago newsman, and Chicago Republican and conservative activist lawyer, Joe Morris. I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for the vacationing Bruce Dumont, the program Beyond the Beltway. We love having you listen. Please keep it up, and we'll be back after these words.
If you look hard enough, go off the beaten track far enough, you'll find an America teeming with the unusual, the odd, the downright strange.
I'm Will Klinger, and I'm your guide on a package tour we like to call
Wild Travels.
Join me for the new Wild Travels series Saturdays at 5:30 and Sundays at 10:30 p.m. on WTTW Channel 11.
You're invited to the biggest party in Texas, the Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo. March 3rd through the 22nd, legends and up-and-comers in concert. Plus, superstar cowboys and cowgirls, blue ribbon livestock and horse shows, western-themed shopping, cool food, acres of carnival rides and games. The Houston Livestock Show and Rodeo.
Party with your boots on.
March 3rd through the 22nd, RodeoHouston.com.
Party with your boots on.
From Baltimore, Maryland to Portland, Oregon, and from Minneapolis, Minnesota down to Austin, Texas, you are listening on POTUS, SiriusXM's Politics of the United States channel. You're listening maybe on terrestrial radio, you're listening maybe on the web, or maybe on our flagship station, the great 89-890 WLS AM, right here in Chicago, 50,000 watts blasting through the airwaves, notwithstanding the snow and the cold of the Midwest. Wherever you are and however you're listening, we're glad you're with us. I'm Chris Roebling, sitting in for Bruce Dumont. We have a real political debate, Walter Jacobson, that is breaking out right in front of us between our friends Bob Cramer and Joe Morris on this central issue of the of what I consider to be the fiscal viability of the post-war public employee union model. And I'm going to say, Bob, I want to press you on this. I want you to address the issue of taxation. If you take all of the people who are in the top 1% and you take all of their earnings for the last year, that will run the federal government for about a week and a half, maybe 2 weeks, maybe. That's it. What do you do after that? The answer has to be you're going to start going into the middle class. Isn't that true?
Well, first, let's be clear. I mean, about 13% of not quite, 12.7% of all the income in the United States is consumed by the top 1% of the population. That is,
and don't they
almost
pay 54%
about half
of
the population. Half of the population makes about 13% of the total income in the United States. I mean, they make that 1% almost as much as the other bottom half. Look, the fundamental problem in our economy today is that ordinary people's incomes have not gone up for 30 years because most of the we have a 77% increase in gross domestic product in the last 35 years, and it's all gone to the top 1% of the population.
Even under
virtually
Barack
all,
Obama.
Virtually all. Well, and now, the president has proposals to address that question. That's exactly where America needs to go. We need unions of all sorts are the principal engine to raise the wages of ordinary Americans, and that's where we need to understand that collective bargaining is a human right, just like free speech.
Joe Morris.
I don't disagree that collective bargaining is an important right in the private sector.
The
dangerous thing that happens in the public sector is you end up with the same people on both sides of the bargaining table, where the unions are obviously representing labor in the public sector, but when the unions then win political control so that they're on the other side of the bargaining table as well, it ends up being what has been in Illinois for a generation and more, and that is self-dealing. You gouge the money out of the pockets of not the wealthy, not the billionaires, but the ordinary middle-class taxpayer. That's who's
Don't you think that public employees should be paid middle-class wages?
Say it again.
Shouldn't public employees make middle-class wages? You think $64,000 a year is too much as an average wage for public employees in the state?
The traditional compact, the traditional deal made with public employees is they've been taken out of politics.
No, I'm asking you about their wages because that's the point you're addressing.
That's the point I'm addressing right now. The deal that we've made with public employees is we've taken them out of politics. We've given them civil service and tenure. We've given them job security and longevity. For the benefit of the taxpayers who have to pay the bills, they don't make what people make in the private sector, and that's perfectly legitimate.
You think they should not make what people make?
That's absolutely right. Not because people in the private sector do not have the same benefits, the same longevity, the same tenure, the same civil service protection.
Bob, do you not agree that the fiscal imbalances have led to very serious and potentially devastating deficit situations?
They are not caused
in states from California to Rhode Island.
They are not caused by people demanding to make a living wage to do what they do for a living. They've been
What's a living wage? We've got people in Illinois,
I think,
because of the COLAs. They retire and they're making $70,000 a year, so they go down to say $55,000. But because of the COLAs, within just a few years, they're making $89,000 or $110,000. Is that fair to the taxpayer?
Most public employees make...
No. I'm asking you about this particular... I'm not asking you most. Is it fair for our taxpayers, whether they're in Indiana or California, to be paying 2 or 3% COLAs to retired public employees?
The choice is not
fair?
I don't know the specifics of your example, but it is not fair to say... Is it fair to say that we should pay our public employees middle-class wages the same way we need to say that in the private sector? The big problem is not between private and public employees. The problem is between the financial sector and this narrow band of people who have siphoned off most of the money from people who actually work for a living for the last 35 years. And that is indisputable that the amount of income and wealth has been concentrated massively to the top 0.01% in the United States.
And I want to
we know that
is under,
fact.
That is under Clinton, and that is under Obama, as well as under. This is not some sort of Republican sneaky plan.
Actually, for about 2 years under Clinton, at the end of his administration, it actually was not the case for a brief period. Began with Ronald Reagan and the attack on unions, in particular. It began with cuts in tax rates for the upper income people in the United States and massive numbers of rigged rules of the game caused this problem.
Now over for the Joe Morris, who said it was mythology. Joe?
You could confiscate the wealth of all the billionaires in the country and you couldn't meet the public debt.
It simply would not happen. The public debt.
There's not enough people to do it.
I see.
In order to pay the bills of the welfare state that Mr. Clinton and Mr. Obama have created, you've got to tax and gouge the money out of middle-class taxpayers. There's no alternative to that. That's exactly what Mr. Obama aims to do.
But, Bob...
And that's exactly what has to happen in Illinois if the unions that control government, the public sector in Illinois, are going to have the pension benefits
is it not the case that this fundamental imbalance has in fact been propelling not just Republicans around the country who now are in control of, I think, 31 governorships, okay, or maybe 32, and there are something like 26 states where the Republicans control the House, the Senate, and the governorship. And the Republicans, since the start of the Obama administration, have taken over the U.S. Senate, have taken over the U.S. House. So, Bob, I mean, I wonder if you're not on a losing side in terms of public understanding of these underlying fiscal imbalances.
Having done a lot of polling on the subject, I'm not on the losing side at all.
Well, then where are the Democrats winning?
Most ordinary people.
Where are the Democrats winning? Let's
be specific.
Two presidential races.
Let's look at Wisconsin. In the last 4 years, Scott Walker has won 3 elections in Wisconsin, twice as governor and once the recall election.
All of them campaigning
on precisely these issues.
Yeah, but you're saying
Here's a blue state that's electing the point man for this curtailing of the unbearable rights of public sector unions. Where do you see the evidence there, Bob?
Your theory, Joe, is that the problems of state government are primarily put at the feet of employee unions that are asking too much to be paid middle class wages. Is that correct?
No, it's the unethical behavior of public sector unions and their politician handmaidens who end up being on both sides of the bargaining.
Well, table. And I'm going to Walter Jacobson for a perspective. I want to ask you, Walter. I want to tell you. I've told this story before, but real quick, I met with 8 Swedish labor journalists one day, and they were from left to far left. I mean, Marxists included, the whole shot. Really a great time. Had a great conversation. We were talking about all of these fiscal imbalances. They were visiting the United States on a Department of State thing. I want to thank Kitty Kurth, who set this all up. When I told them that in the United States, the public employee unions can donate to political candidates, they were slapping their forehead. They said, that's crazy. I mean, the communist among them said, that is absolutely crazy. That's illegal in Sweden. I said, why is it illegal in Sweden? And Bob Cramer and Joe Morris and Walter Jacobson. Because if the public employee unions can pay or can contribute to a political campaign, then who's guarding the taxpayer?
Doesn't that make sense? The Koch brothers should be able to spend unlimited amounts of $900 million and public employee unions can't? What is that?
I'm asking Walter here.
I don't have an answer to that question. I think one of the problems with all this is that the labor movement, the laborers in this country are becoming increasingly less interested in politics than they have been in the past. They're not as well organized. They're not contributing a heck of a lot of money, as you're suggesting they are. And a lot of the labor union members, most, I would say, and I don't have the data to back this up, but most labor union members probably these days are voting Republican.
Actually not.
No, that's wrong.
In fact, labor, you want to take a white man and instead of making him a Republican, make him a Democrat, make him a labor union member. About 65%.
The growth in labor unions is in the public sector. You're absolutely right when you're talking about the private sector labor unions. People actually work for a living.
As opposed to the guys who teach our kids or the people who are our policemen or firemen who don't work for a living. Is that right, Joe?
People who shuffle paper.
That is the – oh, yeah, like firemen, right, who rescue people. They're shuffling paper. Is that correct? That is that kind of characterization of public employee unions is an outrageous affront to the people who work for people for a living.
There are no public employee unions that make automobiles. There are no public in America, in free market America. There are no public employee unions in manufacturing. There are no public employee unions that are building buildings, that are building houses for people.
Right.
That's all private sector. What you're talking about are the public sector services, and the public sector services are, with the exception of emergency responders and the like, are not valued by the American people.
And teachers, you don't think teachers are?
Well, here's what's going on with teachers. Since 1970, Bob, and you know this better than I do, since 1970, this country has doubled its expenditure, in real terms, inflation adjusted, on K-12 education. And what else have we doubled? We have doubled the number of job slots in K-12 education. And what have we to show for that? There's no doubling, I can tell you this. There's no doubling, Bob, of the results or the attainments of the kids in America with respect to math or with respect to English or with respect to foreign language or, gosh help us, with respect to history.
Well, excuse my question, but you know what Mayor Daley the First would say about that? What trees do you plant? Joe Morris, what trees do you plant? I mean, we can't go without firemen and policemen and teachers, can we?
No one is making that suggestion.
Not at all, but we can certainly go with competition.
So we'll pay them less and they'll be better. Like we do in the private sector, right, Joe?
It is Beyond the Beltway and a full-throated debate is broken out. We want to hear from you after these words.
Are you headed to Los Angeles? Looking for the ideal place for you and your family to relax and enjoy yourselves? A place that combines a Four Diamond Hotel experience with a convenient location? It's the Hilton Los Angeles Universal City, just steps away from Universal Studios Hollywood, CityWalk, and NBC Studios. Just a short ride to the Hollywood Walk of Fame, TCL Chinese Theater, Warner Brothers, and other popular attractions. Enjoy spacious rooms offering breathtaking views and a world-class Las Vegas-style seafood and prime rib buffet every weekend and holidays. Share family fun and enjoy the oasis of the palm tree-lined pool and whirlpool. Relax in your own private poolside cabana with a cocktail or snack at your fingertips. Book your reservation today at HiltonUniversal.com or call 1-800-774-1500. The Hilton, Los Angeles, Universal City at HiltonUniversal.com. They let you be the star in Hollywood.
It's time now to hear from you. Our number, we've got a great phone number here at Beyond the Beltway. I'm Chris Roebling sitting in for Bruce Dumont. 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. 1-800-723-8289. If you want to get in on this conversation, I think, Walter Jacobson, that this is the central domestic political issue.
Well, no question about it. Certainly the pension issue right now it is, but you know, you can't ignore that the Supreme Court's going to come down, or indicates it will come down, on the side of the labor movement, and we'll have to deal with that. So those who are so opposed to what the labor unions are demanding have to give us an alternative to solving the problem.
Well, let's ask this. We have a national figure serving as mayor of the city of Chicago. His name is Rahm Emanuel, and he was the chief of staff for at least President Obama, maybe President Clinton or something. He's well known. He was also a senior member of the United States House of Representatives. Rahm Emanuel's answer to this issue has been, Joe Morris, what?
A week. I mean, it's kicking the can down the road yet again. A legislative deferral of the obligations of the municipal pension system under Illinois law, and the Illinois Supreme Court, as Walter correctly is saying, is telegraphing that it is going to hold both the municipal and the state pension systems to a very strict construction of the Illinois constitutional provision that says pensions are not to be diminished. That's a very dangerous place to be in, because it means that if the pensions aren't diminished, that the money has to come from somewhere, and that means taxpayers.
I mean, the central subject of national political battle for the next decade is not pensions. The central battle is raising the income of ordinary Americans. Today, we have a stock market at record highs, we have corporate profits at record highs, and wages as a percentage of national income at record lows. That's our problem. And when it comes to that's true of public employees, it's true of private sector employees. So, we've got to raise wages and benefits for them, not reduce them.
So what has the Obama administration failed to do to reverse that in its first 6 years?
And it's failed to do that. I mean, they've done – well, first they passed the Affordable Care Act, which helped considerably when it comes to ordinary incomes. But – the biggest problem has been the extent to which the Republicans in Congress have stopped everything they have proposed to do that.
You can blame that on Obama.
And the president's State of the Union made a very clear middle class economics agenda, including raising the minimum wage, including changing overtime regulations. There's a wide variety of rules of the game that need to be changed. And they've been met so far by a resounding no by the Republicans in Congress.
Maybe a little late, but so now maybe the first thing the president ought to do is learn how to deal with the Congress. He's a political rookie in Washington. He surrounded himself very early on with people who really didn't know the ins and outs of congressional politics. So he has failed to create the kind of relationships with the other side.
Walter, that's just not true.
The president doesn't care that they want to stop everything he did.
The
president's objective is to move as much as possible to the American economy under federal control, if not direct federal ownership, but certainly regulatory control.
Oh, that's ridiculous.
Well, now he wants the Internet.
What do you mean he wants the Internet?
He wants to take over the
Internet. He wants the Internet to be free and open, as do most Americans.
No, he wants the Internet to be regulated as if it were a utility.
He wants the Internet to be a utility that is run by federal bureaucrats.
That is a utility, which means that it is open to everyone on the same basis, and you can't have private companies selling.
It means it's open to the highest political bidder, and it means it's subject to taxation. It's exactly the opposite of a free.
You'd rather have it open to the highest private company bidder. Is that right?
No, how was the Internet established? It was established with government backing, and once it was opened to the public market, people used it as they saw fit. What is wrong with that model?
Speeds need to be the same for every user. That's the issue.
Joe and Chris argue that the Republican Party in Congress has not been bound and determined to do anything other than give Barack Obama a terribly hard time?
Well, Barack Obama has deserved a terribly hard time, because Barack Obama's trajectory is to move as much as possible control of the American economy into the public sector. And Illinois is a perfect example of why that is dangerous. Just taking the people that Bob Cramer claims, he's sitting here pretending he cares about, public sector employees who are in danger of not having their pensions paid, they have done those public sector employees have done everything that was asked of them. They have paid their money into the public treasury in order to fund their pensions. The taxpayers have done everything that was asked of them. They have paid their taxes into the public treasury. But what has happened is a generation of politicians, not all Democrats, but mostly Democrats, led by the likes of Mike Madigan and Rich Daley in Illinois and in Chicago, have taken the taxpayers' money and, instead of doing what the law required and putting it into those pension funds, have spent it on other things. And what I want to know is, why doesn't Bob Cramer blame them instead of Republicans for the pension fix that Illinois and other similar jurisdictions are in?
Look, the fundamental thing we need is to have more revenue.
Yeah, more tax.
Wait a second. We have one of the lowest levels of taxation in the industrial world in the United States.
Tell that to middle-class taxpayers.
Middle-class taxpayers pay too much because they have not had any increase in their wages in 30 years, while we at the same time have had a 77% increase in gross domestic product per person. So all of that went to somebody else. And let me tell you, it wasn't ordinary people. That's our big problem.
I want to say thank you to the folks who called in here at the end. technical snafu. We weren't able to get them on the air, but we appreciate your calling in. Thank you very much. I've also got to thank Walter Jacobson, Joe Morris, and Bob Kramer for a terrific edition of Beyond the Beltway. It's a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS Radio. I also want to thank Colin Bobbitt, Dylan Klauke, and Dan Dorfman for helping get this program on the air. Until next week, when Bruce Dumont will be back in this chair, it's Chris Roebling substituting for Bruce and saying to you a very warm good night from Chicago.